Hello, and welcome to Music Maps, the Rock and Roll Book Club podcast. In each episode, we'll use a place as a jumping-off point for a conversation about music, anywhere from the obvious to the obscure. So, hello, it's the Music Maps podcast, the Rock and Roll Book Club podcast. And I'm Mark Hart, and with me is Simon Cardwell.
Hello, Mark.
Chief cartographer of the Music Map. And today, our very special guest is Paul Hanley, author and drummer from The Fall and other bands, House of All. That's good, isn't it?
Very good, yeah. First chance we get to talk about The Fall.
Will there be others?
I think, there's so many X4 members. I think we'll
How
sure
many?
To come
56.
Across.
56. Maybe Dave Simpson.
Surely we'll come across another at some point.
So, Paul, we're going to start off in 1980.
Okay.
One day after school, your brother, Steve Hanley, mentions he's been trying to get you into The Fall. What do you remember about that day?
Mike Lee was the drummer in The Fall before me, and they were doing a tour with the Cramps. And Mike, for whatever reason, bizarrely, decided he was going to leave The Fall because they weren't doing enough gigs. And if you look at the gigography, for want of a better word, of that. They did like 120 gigs in the year.
That's not shabby, is it?
No, but I mean, he was
more than that.
Yeah,
whoa.
he was from like the cabaret circuit,
where
you were doing four a weekend or whatever. So he wanted to end the tour at the last date of the tour was in London at the Electric Ballroom with the Cramps. And Kay, who's the manager of The Fall, thought, well, you can get lost. I'm not letting you end on such a high. So they told him he was going to leave the day before the last gig, which a bit mean, but there you go. So that was what we decided. So they had a gig in London at Electric Ball, which is quite a prestigious venue.
It's a big space, isn't it?
A big space,
over 1,000 people.
And so I was a drummer. I mean, I've played one gig in a school band, really. We mainly did Buzzcocks covers. And they said, would you like to do it? And obviously I said yes. Looking back, I think that's pretty good, actually. It's 16.
Yeah.
And I'd only done one gig, and they wanted me to play the Electric Ball. I think I'm quite proud of the fact that I said, no, I didn't say no way I couldn't do that. I said, yeah, I'll do it. And I did it. So, yeah, so I think it came through Steve. So we didn't rehearse, not properly. We had a bit of a run-through of the songs in our shed, because that's where my drum kit was, in our shed in the garden.
How long had you been playing at this point?
About 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah. About 2 years, just under 2 years, probably. But, I mean, that's from first picking up a pair of drumsticks.
How old were you at this point?
16.
16.
I was 16 in the February, and the gig was in the March. So we had a couple of run-through, because the other thing, The Fall aren't like other bands, there was five of the songs, I think it was five, that had never been heard, they'd never been recorded. So there wasn't a tape they could play. Well, it was different then, there wasn't tapes, was there? I mean, but so there was five songs in that set that the first time I ever heard them with Mark E. Smith singing was at the gig. We didn't even do them in the sound check, so.
And was there any nerves in, you know?
I'm sure there were. You've been playing in your shed, yeah.
And then suddenly you've got 1,100 Cramps fans.
I'm sure there were nerves, but I don't remember being crippled. Well, I clearly can't have been crippled by nerves.
Is there a tape, Paul?
There is. It's not bad, actually.
Yeah.
I think
a
tape.
Were you happy with your drumming performance?
I was. I took Welsh Rumble at a bit of a pace. It's a bit too fast. And some of the drum rolls on Fiery Jack are a bit longer than Mike would have ever done. But
were you rebuked by Mark?
Yeah,
Smith?
He said afterwards, some of them drum rolls are a bit long, mate. I wasn't rebuked.
That's not bad, though.
It's not bad, that is it?
That's not bad at all.
So, no, I'm very happy with that gig. And but I wasn't in the band then, by the way. No. That was just...
So you had an audition the following week, I think.
Yeah, something like that. Maybe a couple of weeks after, yeah.
So you've played this gig. You haven't embarrassed yourself. You haven't embarrassed the band. But they still feel there's a need to go and do a proper audition.
Yeah, there was two of us were up for the gig at that point. It was me and a guy called Andy Zero, I think his name was. Not his real name. His real name's Michael Zero. No, I'm joking. Who ran a fanzine in Manchester called City Fun, amongst other people. And he was up for it. What stood in my favour was he'd had a broken arm at some point in the past, and his arm went a bit funny after a few songs.
Oh, right, OK.
So, I mean, I've no idea.
Not on the day. He didn't have a broken arm on the day.
No. But I've no idea how he was, but I got the gig. The way I got the gig, they had an album out, which was, it wasn't out then, but it was due to be out, called Total's Turns.
Yeah.
And one of the songs on there was a song called New Puritan, and it was basically a tape in the bedroom. So there was no drums on it. Yeah. So it was them playing, like, you know, in the bedroom, and Matt just on a crappy cassette.
New Puritan. In L.A., the window opened a switch. It's like a dinosaur cackle, a pterodactyl cackle.
So they started playing New Puritan in this rehearsal in TJ Davidson's, which was like the rehearsal place, space in Manchester. And so I thought, well, there's no drums on this. So I sat there for like 3 or 4 minutes, and Steve was like going, you know, you've got to play on this. So, you know, with his eyebrows, basically. So I started playing, and it got to the end, and Mark said, that drums were fantastic. It was basically me playing the intro to Autonomy by Buzzcocks. If you listen to the beats, they're very, very similar, but it fit the song perfectly. So then Mark said, those drums are fantastic. I really think you should do a drum intro to this song. So he basically commissioned me to write a drum intro. So I did that, and then we did that at the Peel session, which has got like this drum intro, which I basically nicked from, it wasn't quite nicked, but it was, let's shall we say, an homage, as one says, to the drums on Making Plans for Nigel by XTC.
Oh, wow.
So if you listen to that, they're kind of broadly similar. It's not the same, but that's what you do as a musician. You know, you borrow.
So who else was in the band when you joined?
So there was Mark E. Smith, obviously.
Yeah.
Craig Scanlon, Mark Riley, and Steve Hanley, who were like a cabal, really. They were schoolmates.
Yeah.
And I joined, and I was the younger brother. And I'm still the younger brother. Yeah. If the four of us get together, to this day, I'm 60 years of age, and I'm still the baby brother. which is great, you know. You have to have a role in these things, don't you?
Five.
So your first album as a member of the Fall is Grotesque, after the Gram.
That was the name of it. That wasn't your first album. It was Grotesque.
And that's released in November.
Yeah.
But it's preceded by two, I'm going to call them legendary singles, How I Wrote Elastic Man and Totally Wired.
Yeah.
Were those the first things you recorded then after joining?
So we went in the studio Cargo in Rochdale. I'm pretty sure we did How I Wrote Elastic Man and City of Goblins, which is a B-side, and New Face in Hell. We did those three songs the first time I was ever in a recording studio. I think we did New Face in Hell first, I think. I might be wrong, but in my head, we did that first. And then we went back and did Totally Wired and Put a Block.
Totally Wired gets quite a lot of play on Six Music these days.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's one of those, I don't know how you did it, but it's one of those records, from the first drum beat, I can say, that's Totally Wired by the Fall. It's remarkable, I think.
It is.
But that record, those singles are out through Rough Trade. You're at Rough Trade at the time. And they're co-produced by Jeff Travis. Grant Showbiz, the first time you think doing a bit of work with Grant, who was a kind of Fall producer of long standing.
Yeah, so Grotesque, I think there's a couple of tracks that were recorded in Grant's studio in London, Street Level.
Yes. In Ladbroke Grove, is it that one?
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And Mayo Thompson.
Mayo Thompson, yeah.
Yeah.
You have to remember, that was the first time I'd been in a studio.
Yeah.
But I hadn't done much of anything, really. So it wasn't like, oh, I know my way around gigs backwards, but now I'm in a studio. I didn't really know how any of it worked, really. So I'd done like a few, gigs with The Fall, but we went to the studio, and I loved it from the first minute. Being in the studio is my favourite part of being a band. I just think it's that, just being in that space is just, it's never lost its thrill for me at all. I mean, gigs occasionally lose the thrill for me because, well, that'd be funny. A lot of them are the same, you know.
You're doing so many of them.
Yeah, you do a lot of them. We went to the studio, like you say, we had Jeff Travis and Mayo Thompson. I mean, I could have been more nervous if I'd known who either of them were, but I didn't know anybody. I didn't know anything. But I kind of fell into it because there was a dynamic in The Fall and a structure,
yeah,
which everybody knew the place, you know, which I was absolutely fine with.
Would Mark be around? Because, I mean, as a drummer in a studio, the first few hours are you setting up your kit, yeah, aren't they? Is Mark around at,
yes,
these times?
Yeah,
is he present?
I think you'll find that we didn't spend as long on that as possibly some bands do. It wasn't like the first 3 weeks we were doing the bass drum, or, you know, it wasn't Rumours.
Or Stephen Morris with Martin Hannett.
No, not at all. It wasn't like that, no. But, I mean, having said that, they were, certainly for Totally Wired, I remember taking a long time to get that right,
yeah,
to get the sound right, because it's unusual, Totally Wired, and it's one of the reasons it's instantly recognisable. There's no snare on Totally Wired. It's all toms.
Yeah,
and that was because Mark wanted it to sound like a cardboard box. That was the instruction
the
to me. Mark always said he wrote the whole of Totally Wild in its entirety. He wrote every note of it. But his instruction to me was make it sound like a cardboard box. So if that's him writing the whole song, well, fair enough. But
I mean, 44 years on, there is something to be said. As I said, you know, it is, to my ears, instantly recognisable. So there was some alchemy going on.
Oh, yeah.
Whether that's Grant or Jeff or Mayo or you or whatever, something there. And that's, yeah, just incredible. That's the beauty of music, isn't it? It's
the magic
of music.
Definitely. I mean, I had that really crappy kit. I mean, it wasn't really a kit, really. It was this 20-inch Premier. I mean, another thing people don't, maybe they know, maybe they don't know, but The Fall, there was no interest in gear. If you, most bands, people get very anal about gear, whereas The Fall, that was kind of seen as,
yeah,
a bit pathetic, really.
I think the Slate CP comes next, and it's, again, it's a record that's got a great reputation amongst Fall fans, but it's not quite an album.
It's 10-inch.
Yeah. 10-inch, yeah.
It's one of the greatest 10-inch records ever made.
I mean, is there a lot of competition there? I don't know.
Wow. I love Slate. I mean, what, six tracks, seven tracks?
Six tracks, yeah. I mean, it was Mark's attempt to piss off Rough Trade, basically.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the, you know, there was the indie chart that was, you know, used.
So
I mean, quite legitimately by, you know, to say we're doing well, you know, or not doing well. But it didn't qualify for either. Because it wasn't a single, it wasn't an album. I think that was the main reason Mark did it.
What are your memories of Slate?
I mean, Slate, we were in the studio in London, and that was definitely Grant was in charge there in terms of production. But we also had Jeff Travis, and we also had Adrian Sherwood.
Oh,
on New Sound,
yeah,
he came down. He was there, and he did this great thing where he put a speaker at the bottom of the stairs with the bass drum going through it. Grant always says it's a snare, but it was the bass drum, so I'm concerned. And then a mic at the top of the stairs. So you got this complete natural reverb on the bass drum. But stuff like that was completely like nothing like I'd ever done before, or probably since. I mean, he did this like studio magic, you know, like Brian Wilson or whatever.
Yeah.
But it was great. And the thing about Slates is there's no flab. Six songs, in and out, all six songs are great.
Yeah.
Fabulous. I loved it. And I think Leave the Capital is one of my favourite things I ever played on. You named a
book after it.
I did, indeed, name a book after it, yes.
So the old drummer, Carl Burns, comes back.
Yes.
You can't get a visa to go to the US.
What happened was there was this massive tour of America coming up, and it was probably the biggest tour The Fall ever did in America. It was everywhere. So it was East Coast, Deep South, West Coast, everywhere you care to mention that was going. I was 17. So whether it was we can't get this guy a visa or he's never going to be able to act this, I think there's a bit of both possibly. But it was probably true. I think it probably killed me to try and do that. At 17 years of age, to go and do this ridiculous. I mean, it was a hell of a slog.
It's been a while since I read Steve's book, but I've got a sense. Correct me if I'm wrong. Was Mark? I get a sense he was quite paternal. Didn't he encourage you to stay on and continue your studies? Or?
Yeah, yeah. So him and Kay, so Kay was the manager. They said to me when I joined at 16, one of the provisos of you joining the fall is you're going to have to stay on and do your A levels. You can do it at college, but you're not joining a band at 16 for that to be the only thing you can ever do, you know, which was amazing. And I mean, to this day, I thank them for that because obviously, you know, I ended up writing, but it gave me a love. I mean, I loved English literature anyway, so I did English literature for A level and I loved it. And God bless them for that. I mean, you know, it was the right thing to do, and it was, and it changed my life in a lot of ways.
I think it also, so Kay Carroll, obviously former manager, had a fearsome reputation.
Oh, I, very scary woman.
Yeah, and you know, and Mark is this well known now. You know, had his moments, shall we say? But yeah, there was something reading that, and there. What seemed to be genuine concern for your well-being? Well,
definitely. I mean, there's no way to spin it. You know, you can say Mark did certain things that suited him and spun it in a different way that he was being altruistic. But that one, there's no way to spin that. That wasn't them trying to look after me.
Yeah. Were you worried that with Carl coming back, Carl's a great drummer, obviously, that there might not have been room for you?
Yeah. I mean, it was a no-brainer as far as I could see. I mean, the last thing anybody was going to do was have two drums. They went off to America with Carl. So we were never big on rehearsing. So we did a tour of Europe where we did Nights About. So one night I'd play and Carl would do the lights. And then the next night he'd play and I'd do the lights. So we did that. And then by the end of that, Carl was match fit and knew all the songs. And they went off to America and, like I say, did this ridiculous tour. And I was sort of left in England. It was sold to me that this was definitely a one-off, but there was definitely a concern. Well, they've just been to America with one of the greatest drummers in the world. I loved Carl's drumming. It's no secret that my three favourite drummers in the world were John Marr, Carl Burns, and Steve Morris. And Carl, I just thought Carl was a phenomenal drummer. Well, he was. I mean, if you listen to Live at the Witch Trials, he's just a phenomenal drummer. But having said that, so, it was sold to me that he wasn't staying, but but then when we came back, we did a couple of gigs and we did a Peel session and then we went to Iceland.
Yeah.
I kind of got the impression that Mark was angling to get Carl in. He kind of criticised me a bit and the way I played when we went in the studio because I was dying. And the reason I was dying was there was no beer in Iceland at that stage. It was only spirit. Well, what a ridiculous... So the licensing laws were, if we make beer legal, everyone's going to get drunk all the time, but we'll make wine and spirits legal. So consequently, everybody was off their head. And I was 17 and I'd never drunk spirits in my life. And I have to say, I'd never drunk spirits since. So we did a night and I drank vodka and orange and then we were in the studio the next day and I was dying. But having said that, we did Hit Priest, Iceland and Lucknow in a day. And I don't think the drumming's too bad on them, I don't think. So I think it was manufactured by Mark that he was dissatisfied with my drumming. That was why he wanted to get Carl back in. And I don't think at that point there was enough of a beef about me for Steve, Craig and Mark to wear it, to say, yeah, you're right, we'll sack. I mean, it would have been a bit awkward, wouldn't it, sacking your brother? I mean, the compromise was that we both played drums. And thank God we did, because I absolutely...
So whose idea was the two drummers?
It was Mark's. I mean, it was obviously
Mark's.
Yeah.
Where's that coming from? I mean, because if I think of two drummers, obviously you think of the Glitter Band.
You
don't
do, yeah.
So, and I'm sure there are others, but that's the first one that comes to mind.
Adam and the Ants were just about starting about the same time, I think.
So what was the studio like in Iceland? I mean, how did you come to go to Iceland? Grant Showbiz, I think, we're recording Hex.
Yeah, yeah. We hadn't started recording Hex yet.
Hadn't you?
No, this was the first thing we did, yeah. So we was basically doing some dates in Iceland. So this guy called Einar basically accosted Kay outside Rough Trade and said, I'm from Iceland, we'd love to put you on. And he was like 17 or something, 18. And Kay could have either said, don't be so bloody stupid, nobody plays in Iceland. Or she could have took him at his word and said, well, if you can organise it, we'll go over, which is what happened.
So what was the Icelandic studio like? I mean, I'd heard that, you know, it's kind of dug into the... Its walls are made of, I don't know, lava or something. I mean, and that affects the sound. How's that compared to Cargo?
Right, well, the thing about it was, it wasn't... Mark always made out it was a cave. I mean, that's... It wasn't a cave, but it was a very, very posh studio because, I mean, unsurprisingly, there aren't that many studios in Iceland.
No.
So there was a studio that could record a symphony orchestra and, you know, it was a beautiful studio, really. Probably the poshest studio I've ever been in, I think. But it was, like, the walls were lined with volcanic rock.
Yeah.
Inside. It wasn't in a cave, it was in a building.
Yeah, yeah.
But the walls were lined with volcanic rock, which, so... Whether it was the fact that we were in a studio that was far more high-end than we were used to, or the volcanic rock might have had a difference, I don't know. And maybe it was the whole... I mean, it was clearly Mark was in a very kind of fruitful artistic place, I think. I mean, he wrote Iceland, yeah, the song. And, you know, we went in the studio, we did Hit Priest, which is one of the recordings that people always talk about with The Fall. We did Look No, which was the next single, and when we didn't actually use that, we recorded it again. And then Mark said, right, we've had enough pissing about here, let's do something new. I mean, enough pissing about, we'd been in that studio 6 hours, and from start to finish, with unfamiliar gear, by the way, that was, yes, you know,
hired drum kit.
Yeah, 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 oh yeah, hired drum kit, and we'd recorded Hit Priest, which, like I say, is one of the key...
The hired drum kit was probably better than the kit you were playing, you just said.
Oh, 100 times better, yeah, yeah. Well, it stood up without falling over for a start. But again, it was unfamiliar. So we did that, and then we basically wrote Iceland from nothing. Mark had that, you know, they had that, Craig had that piano, famously. Well, I say famously. Famously, if you follow these kind of things. Mark said he wanted something Bob Dylan-ish. Right, which he was really, really... Because the other thing to remember about the Iceland tour is we had a guy from Melody Maker, Colin Irwin, came with us, like war correspondent. Like,
yeah.
So he followed us all around and, you know, he spent a lot of time with Mark. The other interesting thing is he spent a lot of time with us as a band. So if you read the article, it's a really good article and you get a real feel for what it was like being in The Fall, you know. And it was like, you know, 90%... perspiration, the band, and 10% inspiration, Mark, you know, and yeah, you really get that. We had, you know, the first gig we did, we had to go and build a stage. It was in the basement of a hotel that didn't have a stage. So, oh, the lads will go and, you know, so we had to go and pick up this bloody stage from somewhere, take it to the venue, set it up, build the stage. So we worked pretty hard, you know, in The Fall. So then we went in the studio and Mark said he wanted something Bob Dylan-ish. And Craig started doing this bomb, 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 can rally around people, which is what he says is what he was trying to play on the piano. But it's nothing like the times they are changing at all. But he came up with this song, and it fits Mark's lyric perfectly, which is, you know, we'd never heard Mark's lyric. Mark never showed anyone his lyric before he did them. I mean, if it had been crap, it just wouldn't have been used. But as it turned out, you catch that kind of lightning in a bottle moment. And Iceland's great. I think it's fantastic. But
you've been back since.
In 83, we went, stopped off on the way back from America.
Oh, okay.
We did a couple more gigs there, but I've never been back since. I would like to go back, actually. I can't get my wife to go. It's too cold.
I mean, Hit Priest, we're jumping on a bit, but obviously ends up in the final scene of Silence of the Lambs, the Jonathan Demme film.
He was a bit of a fan of Manchester music, Jonathan Demme.
Well, Jonathan famously, did New Order's Perfect Kiss. Do you know, Simon, I was in the studio, Amazon Studios in Liverpool, when New Order came in to mix the sound for the Perfect Kiss video.
Wow.
What was it? What did it feel like being in a cinema and hearing the track that you played on?
I'm pretty amazing, actually, because...
Cinemas have good sound, don't they?
If you remember the scene, she's got he's got a night vision camera. And
she's in a well
in the basement.
Or something.
The victim's in the well, yeah, and Jodie Foster's trying to catch Buffalo Bill.
Yeah.
But the big thing for me was we stayed to watch the credits, so as you would, and it came up P. Anley, you know, Hit Priest, written by P. Anley.
Fantastic.
I mean, the woman was waiting to throw us out and sweep up, but it was a long way down. But that was a big moment for me. I was, you know, and because the thing about Hit Priest was it was a it was a five-way co-write between the five people in the band. Yeah, I mean, it couldn't have been any other way because it was completely organically written. Hit Priest. It was Mark had this. I don't know what idea Mark. I in my head it starts with the drums because that drum beat was me trying to combine Steve Morris's, you know, that bum 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 bum. Ba-da-da-da-da. I can't think what song it is. It's on Unknown Pleasures, and it was combine that with Fiery Jack, which is the cabaret beat, which is a ridiculous thing to try and meld together because Mark was obsessed with that cabaret beat, and it's on the North Will Rise Again as well.
Yeah.
So in my head, that drum beat is a cross between Steve Morris and Mike Lee, which is ridiculous, but it kind of is. That's what it is if you listen to it. So I started playing that at a sound check, and we started playing it, and we did it that night. It's actually on video. You can see it. We played Leeds.
Yeah.
And we played it once in the sound check, and Mark started singing over it. And then the next time we played it was at the gig. And that was the first time we played it. So, but it evolved over a number of months.
Yeah.
And so the dynamics in it were kind of completely naturally and organic. So but by the time we recorded it, we knew it really well. And I always say the great thing about X Induction Hour is the balance between songs we knew really well and knew how to do and knew how to take up and take down, and songs that we didn't know at all.
Hmm.
So, and this day, nobody knew that. And I don't think anybody would ever know that. It was the most uncerebral song of all time. It's just a racket of people playing five different riffs that don't match together, you know.
Was there a transition to the two drummers?
It took a bit of work. It took a bit of work. We did, so there were certain songs that we kind of adapted to be two drummers and certain songs we wrote. I mean, the first one that I remember that was clearly had two drummers on it and you couldn't really do it justice with one drummer was the classical. Certain songs, you could have changed them back. So, like, we'd done Deer Park. There's a recording of that with just Carl on a part of America there. And there's a recording of that when we did the Peel session with just me on. You could do that with one drummer, but the classical doesn't really work. There's two drummers playing two completely different things and really complementing each other, and it doesn't really work with one drummer, I don't think, that song. I mean, it has been tried a couple of times. I think, you know, Mark went back to it years later and did it for a video and things, but that was just a joy. I mean, there's a few songs later on that were two drummers and don't really work with one drummer, but that one was the first.
For lots of Four fans, this period that you're in, and certainly the 1982, is a pinnacle. Hex Induction Hour is classic. I mean, obviously,
but
Four
I think
history.
Mark's on record saying that it could have been the last Four album.
Yeah, but none of us knew that.
Yeah, of course.
So whether that means...
Of course no one knew that.
No, but whether that means he kept it from us or he made it up after.
Yeah, yeah.
We were pretty busy after it came out, and you don't book gigs in 5 minutes. No. So we had gigs booked, so you can read into that what you will. If he'd really said that this was it and he was calling it a day after that, you know, we didn't, there was no break while we tried to scrabble around to rebook some gigs. There was plenty of gigs going on, so
yeah.
I'm not so sure that's true. Yeah,
and this is the first full album to kind of bother the proper charts, isn't it?
Yeah, it actually gets in the proper album chart first time.
I think Mark, we all were, I think Mark was massively surprised how well received it was. I think he set out to say, well, fuck you, you know, that we're going to do whatever we want. And then everybody loved it. And I talk about that in the book. You know, it was used as like a benchmark. So you'd see a review of Susan the Banshees and they'd say, this is like their Hex Induction Hour. You'd see Echo and the Bunnymen and it'd be like, you know, they finally attempted to do something that's along the lines of Hex Induction. You know, and I don't think he liked that at all, Mark.
The front cover's interesting. Because I think HMV would only display it backwards.
Apparently so. Yeah. Apparently, yeah. But well, why would you just not display it though? Yeah. I don't get that. But, it's a weird cover. Yeah. I mean, I think it's a brilliant cover, and it's like, it really represents the album. There's so many ideas on that album, and I never realised just how clever it was. I always thought it was great.
Yeah.
But when I came to write the book.
Yeah.
I kind of realised just how clever this and how many layers and how many there's themes running through the songs, musically and lyrically. You know, there's this thing where the time doesn't work properly, and so you'll get Winter, where the drums go out of, the drums and bass go out of sync with the rest of the music, which is Mark. That was Mark's idea, and clearly it was a terrible idea. I mean, that's just ridiculous, Mark. You know, if we'd have had enough clout, we would have said no. But Mark, what Mark said, we do, because you don't do that. You don't wipe the drums and bass off and then overdub them, because there was no click track or anything.
No.
So they go completely out of time. But if you listen to the lyric, the song's, the time, linear time doesn't work in the lyric. Mirsud, Mark's singing the same riff that the guitars are playing, but not at the same time. So this whole thing where the laws of time don't work carries across, and he mentions his HIP in Step Sideways, which is Hit Priest, you know. But it just blows my mind just how clever it was, really. And I mean, I was, you know, a dumb 17-year-old drummer. I didn't realise. I knew it was great.
And it's not one of those ones that people realise is great later, because it was a commercial success.
Yeah, it was. Amazingly, it was, yeah.
And Mark Riley, towards the end, nice to do. Mark Riley, who's kind of, in terms of full members, long-standing member, but he leaves towards the end of that year. How does his departure play out? He forms his band, The Creepers, not long after.
Not long after.
Something he wanted to do? Was there, or was it just Mark?
I think there's a bit about Mark Smith was kind of got more and more dismissive of Mark's contribution, completely unfairly, in my opinion, and turning him down, and, you know, that's too loud, that Mark, and all this kind of thing. And when we did Room to Live, he was doing stuff like not having a day in the studio, where he told Mark we were having a day off, and, you know, which is really, really not on. And, he did it one time where Mark turned up and Arthur Cadman was playing guitar. I mean, it's all very well saying, I want to strip down the process and use other people. But you don't get a guitarist into a band that's got two guitarists already. It's not right. And it was a horrible, horrible experience, the whole of recording Room to Live. But he was kind of that, and I think Mark was becoming to the conclusion, Mark Riley was coming to the conclusion that he shouldn't have to just go along with everything Mark said, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he'd been in the Fall since the first album. And we were kind of a bit of a gang, really, the four of us. So Mark's solution, Marky Smith's solution, was to get rid of Mark. And, you know, I'm really not proud of the fact that we let it happen. But I think in the end it worked out. I don't think Mark could have stayed much longer, because he was getting frustrated. And like you said, he had it in him to write his own kind of stuff. And we did his first single. We played on his first single. Which was Favourite Sister. And I love playing on that. So I think it worked out well enough for everybody then, but I still feel very guilty of the fact that we didn't... Because they did it for me when we were getting Carl, and they said, you know, you can't sack Paul.
Yeah.
I really feel that we should have done the same. But I think Steve did. Steve said to Mark Riley, I'll have to leave as well. And Mark said, well, no, I don't want that, because, I'm not going to be responsible for you losing this thing that you love more than anything. I don't want you to leave. So, but maybe we should have. I don't know. But it worked out.
Yeah. Well, the band carry on.
He's done all right, hasn't he?
Well, yeah.
So on the next US tour, you actually get to go on it this time.
Ooh.
How were The Fall received by an American audience?
Pretty well, actually. Pretty well.
What kind of venues, size of venues are you playing?
So we played the Danceteria in New York.
And what's that?
That's...
800,000?
800, maybe. Oh. We played First Avenue in Minneapolis,
yeah.
Which I'm very proud of, because that's obviously
that
where
Prince
Purple
is.
Rain, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that was the first time I'd ever seen, they had videos.
Yeah.
So they were videoing the band, which obviously the Hacienda ripped off a bit later.
Yeah.
So they had a video feed to tellies at different parts of the club, because it was a big club.
Yeah.
And, so, yeah, I mean, that's one of my high points of playing. I mean, I didn't know who Prince was at the time. But
there's the counterfactual, Simon.
Yeah.
Prince Marky Smith, I
well,
imagine.
when I went back to The Fall in 86, we did some recording. Mark told me that Prince had all The Fall albums. Someone had told him. But the thing about that is, you could say that. No one's going to say, oh, that's bollocks. Because who would ever know? And I remember saying, God, the idea that Prince knows anything I've played on would be amazing. But so whether it's true, I don't know.
Well, Elton John.
Elton John, yeah.
Elton John for a long time, I think, has buys all this, every single that comes out. I'm sure Elton John has got a soft spot for The Fall.
He has. I think, I might be wrong, I think there's a quote from Elton John about The Fall, I think, maybe,
yeah.
About on the Tube or something, not the London Underground, on the TV programme.
We'll have to look for that, Simon. Yeah.
There's a lot of people down. Nick Cave, someone is on record, I think.
Well, Nick Cave, I mean, the Birthday Party were big Fall fans.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the reasons,
yeah.
You know, they moved to London, one of the bands they cited was The Fall, and you know, we went to see them at the Rafters, and they were clearly big Fall fans, and we did a gig with them, one of the great gigs of the time I was with The Fall. We played with them at Hammersmith Palais, and they supported us, obviously. And you know, they were brilliant. They were brilliant.
Yeah,
the Birthday Party, and they were great that night. Mark Riley always says we blew them away. You know. They came on, they had a fire eater and they did everything to try and... they definitely did have a fire eater, but they did... He says that, you know, they did everything to try and blow us off the stage, and we just went on and played And This Day for like 15 minutes. It's like the second song in the set, you know, which is just... I don't know if you're familiar with the song And This Day,
yeah.
But it's smacking. It's not...
No, The Fall were an onslaught. I mean, they're two drummers.
Yeah.
And the, you know... Steve on the bass. There's no quarter given.
No.
The other, I mean, of course, we're now in 1983, and of course, then there's this huge change because Brick Smith suddenly appears. How did that feel, and what did Bricks bring to the band? We believe it's a pop sensibility.
In terms of pop, I think her big thing was marketing as a pop band.
Yeah.
I don't think, now people might see it differently.
When you say marketing, you mean hair as a foxy blonde woman on the stage.
I don't think they were afraid to use that, but I don't think the writing ever changed. I don't think we ever sat down and said, right, we need to write a hit single now. Well, certainly not while I was in the band. They might have done like, I don't think they did because they ended up doing cover versions, didn't they? But I think her idea was we can make this big without compromising the sound, I think.
Yeah.
And, you know, we signed to Beggar's Banquet. That was a big thing. They weren't quite a major, but they were near enough. And they spent a lot of money, you know, on recording. We've been in studios far better than we'd ever been in before.
I don't know if this is common with all members of The Fall, Paul, but you have played other instruments on Fall songs. Guitar, keyboards,
yeah,
the grand piano. Are you a pianist? Are you a trained pianist,
no.
Paul?
No. So basically, you can't have two drummers on everything. Having said that, that's of all of Justin, two albums with two drummers on everything. But if you listen to any of the Fall albums that's got two drummers on, they've not all got two drummers on. So Carl played second bass. So if you listen to like Lay of the Land, there's a bass solo at the end that's just Carl, which is fantastic, obviously. My first thing was whatever Mark Riley wasn't playing, so we had a song called Session Musician, which never made it onto record, and I played keyboards on that because Mark played guitar, and Mark played keyboards on Winter, so I ended up playing guitar. And then when Mark left, so we had it so that some songs were two drummers, some songs were Mark were Carl on second bass, some songs were me on keyboards. I kind of inherited the keyboards from Mark, really, which I really enjoyed, actually. But, so when we did... the one I played grand piano on is Clear Off. So we did... As we were saying, there was a lot more money about when we signed to Beggar's Banquet, so we ended up in better studios. And so when we did... A Wonderful and Frightening World Of and Call for Escape route, which we did at the same time. We were in this really nice studio which had this massive grand piano. And we were working with John Leckie, who was kind of a legendary producer. You know, he's produced George Harrison,
John Lennon.
John Lennon, yeah.
Stone Roses.
Obviously the Stone Roses first album.
Yeah.
I mean, what a pedigree that guy had. But one of the typical things about The Fall is we never asked him about any of that. He just took the piss out of his purple pants, basically. So we're in the studio and it had this grand piano and he said, you should do a little bit at the end on this grand piano. But if you listen to it, it's two notes. I'm two-fingered. I can't play piano at all. I can play a little bit now. Got a piano at home, but when I say a little bit, I mean a really little bit. But I love playing keyboards. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
So Creep is the... I play keyboards on Creep.
You?
Yeah, that's me, yeah.
Yeah.
So that album comes October 1984, Wonderful and Frightening Wonderful. Yeah, yeah. So Brix's involvements kind of changed the sound.
I think they changed... They don't think they changed the songwriting, Brix's involvement, necessarily, but it changed how much you spent on recording, if you like. Well, that was because we signed to Beggars, but we probably signed to Beggars because Brix wanted the Fall to be a commercial enterprise.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On the subsequent tour that follows the release of that album, things take a downward turn when your equipment, the band's equipment, is nicked in Cardiff.
Yeah.
Somehow Marky Smith blames the band for this. What happened?
As I remember it, I was thinking of leaving. I got to the point in at the end of maybe halfway through 84, well, I was thinking, this is never going to be my band.
Yeah.
I'm a member of the Fall, and it's great, but I'd like to be in a band as important a member as anybody else. And which I think basically was a stupid thing, because I was in the Fall, for Christ's sake. Just shut up and get on with it. You know, you're in the Fall, is what I would look at now. But at the time, so there was the thing was, there was me and a couple of my mates who were in the Creepers, and they were in the same position. It was never going to be their band. So we harboured ideas to form our own band. And I said to Mark, I'm thinking of leaving. And he said, well, you're mental, because there's more interest in the band than there's ever been. There's more...
You're on a almost major
label,
as you say.
We're on almost a major label. Things are going great. Things are going
charts.
So he said, well, just put it in your back pocket. Let's do this year and see how you feel at the end of it. Fair enough. Again, you know, that was quite good of him. You know, that was quite level-headed and looking after me in a way. He just said, you're mad to leave the Fall now. So I said, all right, so we'll do that. So we did the gigs. And then I felt more involved in the Fall than I'd ever been. I was, you know, I think I was getting to put songwriting ideas forward, and people were asking my opinion for the first time in 4 years. And I thought it was great. And then we did this gig in Cardiff, like you say, and what happened was, for whatever reason, the van wasn't parked against the wall, so you couldn't open the back doors. We came down next morning, and everything had been nicked except Steve's bass cab, because it was too heavy to get out there. But what happened next was, we went to Brighton, and Mark basically went off on one and said the reason it had all happened was because he was letting people have their say in the Fall. And he had this big stick and he was waving it about, and I mean, ridiculous.
How did he get a stick?
Now, God knows where he got the stick from. But he was basically saying, I'm going to have to start taking control again. And I thought, if I don't leave now, I've said at the beginning of the tour, I want to be in a band that's got more about me. We've done this tour and it's been great. And now Mark's telling me that it's shit because he's not in charge. So I thought, well, if I don't leave now, I'm never going to leave. So I've been painting myself into a corner a bit, really. So then after this gig in Brighton, which we used hired gear for, I thought, I'm leaving, I'm going to go. So I got up at like 6 o'clock in the morning and went to the coach station. And unbeknownst to me, Steve, my brother, got up at 6:30 and went to the train station.
Right.
So we both left the same day without either of the other one knowing that they were both leaving. I don't think Steve ever intended to stay away. He was, you know, his wife, he just had his first child and things were a bit fraught and, you know, he was a bit ill, Paul, and it wasn't easy. So he kind of took a leave of absence, really. But as far as I was concerned, that was it. I was leaving.
So you were quite definitive on it.
I was very completely definitive about it, and I've never regretted it, really. So I left, and then Steve went back after a few months, and I formed a band with my mates from the Creepers, who didn't really do, you know, we didn't really do a lot, really, you know, because we weren't good enough. That was basically it. It was I wasn't capable of running my own band. As it turned out, amazingly enough, that none of us were. Yeah, so Mark said, we've got this all groups that we'd like to use the band. And so I did it. And I mean, that was great. That was with Michael Clark. I mean, that was, what an honour that was to play with Michael Clark, you know. Brilliant.
And I think from what you've said, your relationship with Mark was generally okay.
Yes, I think we had a healthy relationship, me and Mark, because he was my boss.
Yeah.
We weren't best mates. It wasn't like sometimes he was my mate and sometimes he was my boss. He was always my boss. You know, and I think that's quite healthy. And he was like any other boss in a lot of ways, you know, where you can have a laugh with him, but it's got to be his laugh. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. You can, you know, can have a laugh about certain things, but it isn't. It's never at his expense. That's the dynamic of a boss, you know, a worker and a boss, isn't it? And I've worked in, you know, I've worked for a living for the last 40 years, and that's always the dynamic with your boss in a lot of ways, you know. Which is, it's not ideal, but it's not unhealthy.
No.
And everybody knows where they stand.
Yeah.
So that was fine. That worked for me fine. It got a bit more tricky with Steve because, just purely by dint of being in the band 20 years, then sometimes he's your mate, sometimes he's your boss, and you never know where you stand, you know. But I always knew where I stood, which is quite, like I said, that was quite healthy. And I loved my time in the Fall, and I wouldn't. One of the things we said when we did Oh Brother, the podcast, was there's enough out there of people moaning about being in the Fall.
Because there are plenty of people. In fact, Richard Boone recently, you know, said, you're not proper, the Fallen, still not properly appreciated. Mm. Probably not given the kudos that they actually deserve.
I think certainly there's more now than there was even 5 years ago. I think people, I noticed that when you say, you know, you say, oh, I was in a band, and a few years ago you'd say, all right, who are they? And you'd say the Fallen. A lot of people would go, but that doesn't happen now. Everybody knows who the Fall are.
And the podcast, how many episodes do you think you've done
like
now?
Three series, I think, maybe three and a half.
Who's the most surprising Fall fan that you've encountered? We touched upon Michael Demme before, obviously.
Jonathan Demme.
I mean, is there anybody else who
you're
aware
Perry. Of? Grayson Perry's a Fall fan.
Obviously, you're not going to be able to do Prince. We talked about Prince.
Prince is a massive Fall fan. If you ask anybody, now... Have a word with Wendy and Lisa, they'll tell you Prince, he was obsessed with the Fall.
Stuart Lee, there's a few celebrity Fall fans, aren't there?
There are. I mean, Stuart Lee, I think.
Have you done him?
Yeah, Stuart Lee's been on, Frank Skinner's a big Fall fan.
Yeah.
Which is slightly less, but Stuart Lee's material is a bit like the Fall gig, I think.
Could you give us, if not your best, just one of your best Mark E. Smith stories?
The one that I always remember is the bass player out of Suede, Matt Osman.
Yeah.
He tells a story where they were supporting the Fall. Suede was supporting the Fall. Mark was dead helpful. So he came out and said, oh, great, and I really like your band. You know, if there's anything you need, you know, just let me know. You know, this is going to be a great gig. I'm really glad you're playing the gig. And so then they did the gig and they were so chuffed that Mark was so nice. And then he was on the radio that night. Being interviewed. So they were all listening to it, and he said, so the guy interviewed him, and he said, are there any other bands who are going at the moment who have caught your ear? And he says, no, not really. So what about Suede? What do you think of them? Never heard of them.
Right, true or not, Mark. Hex Induction Hour producer Richard Mazda later became an actor appearing in Saving Private Ryan, Batman Begins and Love Actually.
True. I tell you, in Love Actually, he produces Billy Mack's single. So he's the producer. So not only did he produce Hex Induction Hour, he also produced Christmas Is All Around Us.
1984 track Disney's Dream Debased was inspired by a Mark E. Smith trip to Disneyland. On that trip, which of the following rides did Mark decide was evil? Is it Space Mountain, the Matterhorn Bobsleds, or Mr. Toad's Wild Ride?
I'm sure we spoke to Bricks a few years ago, and there were some stories about that trip to Disneyland. Of course, just the very... The idea that Mark E. Smith goes to Disneyland is absurd, isn't it? I've heard of Space Mountain, not the other two. Mr. Toad's Wild Ride.
The Matterhorn's the big mountain.
Okay.
Where's my buzzer? I could buzz in at this point. I know.
I'm going to let Paul buzz in.
It was the Matterhorn.
Yeah.
And he had a premonition. Well, this is how the story goes. He had a premonition that the ride was evil. And later that day in Disneyland, there was a woman decapitated on the Matterhorn.
Oof.
Which is a matter of record. There was a woman decapitated on
it's
the...
Incredible.
She stood up at the wrong bit and it took her up.
Dear me. Also in 1984, Paul, dispel this myth or not? Were Motown Records interested in signing the Four?
Well, this is a myth. Well, it's like all the best myths, there is a kernel of truth in it. So, 1984, Motown opened like a sort of offshoot, London-based offshoot, and it was, right. I can't remember the guy's name now, he was slightly interested in one of the, he probably spoke to every band in London, but one of the people he spoke to was The Fall. But it was never going to happen. And Mark, apparently Mark sent them ex-induction hour, which it was. Well, it wasn't like Berry Gordy was sat in his office one day and he was about to sign The Fall and he put ex-induction hour
it's
on.
A link that not many people would make.
No. It was. I don't think it would have even been called Motown. I think Berry Gordy famously has, you know, he's quite a good business acumen, and I think he thought England and independent music would be quite a way of making money, but no, we were never going to sign to Motown.
Right, final one, Mark. In between stints in the Four, Carl Burns worked in McDonald's.
No idea. I guess everyone's got to do a job, haven't they? So McDonald's, I don't know Carl, so I've got a feeling no.
Do you know the answer to this, Paul?
I don't think he works at McDonald's. He works as a motorbike courier. Yeah. I know that, which is on record as one of the most dangerous jobs in the world.
In one of the articles I read, it did say, I think it might even be in Steve's book, that he had briefly worked in a McDonald's between when he left and when he rejoined. And
right, it's possible. It's certainly possible.
At the end of each episode, we each recommend something. It'd be something you've liked for a long time, something you've recently discovered. Paul, would you like to go first?
I tell you what, I'm going to recommend an air fryer. I've got a Tefal air fryer. Fantastic, they are.
That's the book you should write, Paul.
Yeah, I'll tell you. I could write
the Four Cookery Book.
Yeah, I could write it. So Steve, famously, Steve's a trained chef, and Simon's a chef as well.
Oh, wow. Right.
Yeah. I don't think either of them used an air fryer, but.
Generally, Deer Park by the Four. I love Deer Park.
Deer Park by the Four.
Fantastic.
Beautiful.
No, I tell you what, I must get back into it. One of the things in the last year or so, I was late to this, but there's a Netflix series called Drive to Survive about Formula One.
Right, so mine is, there's a fantastic article on The Quietus about Hex Induction Hour.
It is.
Written by John Doran.
Yeah.
Where he's getting drunk with Marquis Smith.
Is it Doran?
Is it Duran or Doran? You can tell us.
Duran.
But there's this fantastic article where he's sitting in a hotel bar with Marquis Smith, so I'm going to recommend that.
Yeah, I tell you what, I use that in my book quite extensively as well.
Yeah.
He did a great job of getting Mark to talk about it, because Mark starts off saying, I'm not talking about some fucking album I made 20 years
ago. When I started reading it, I was thinking, it's a difficult assignment, isn't it?
There's an interview with John Doran and Doran and John Doran. At the end, he talks. There's an interview with Mark, and it is hilarious. And it's the one where they talk about how they were commissioned to write a song for Twilight, The Four. And Mark says, at the end of the day, vampirism's still a crime, you know.
A big shout out to The Quietus, the people at The Quietus. It's a great read. John and Luke Turner and all the writers do amazing stuff there. So if you don't already subscribe to The Quietus, you should, because times are hard for people out in the new media world and they deserve your money. I think all that remains, Simon, we should mention that Paul, he does have a new book. It's kind of been soft launched, but Paul has a book. It's
a Buzzcocks book.
Buzzcocks. It's called 16 Again.
Yeah, we've just done a live event on this today. There's Paul Hanley, Malcolm Garrett and Richard Boone. We're going to be releasing it online at some point in the future.
Published by Root Publishing, based out of Pontefract, whose Paul's previous two books have been published by, and fine people they are. So look out for that. It's a bright yellow cover. A book designed by Malcolm Garrett himself. So one for your bookshelves.
You'll get a full episode with Paul. You'll also get a Buzzcocks episode somewhere down the line.
All that remains is to say a big, massive thank you to the huge genius that is Paul Hanley. Thank you, Paul.
Thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Yay!
Thank you very much. Good night, God bless.